Hello and welcome to Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's show...
You can't say, oh, we'll do climate change once we've sorted out the global financial crisis. This is, again, just fantastically badly informed politics. The upside of this is that actually they can help sort out the global financial crisis by doing more about climate change.
The environmentalist Jonathan Porritt gives us his thoughts on whether politicians get the urgency of climate change. And he also explains why a better informed public is crucial to the future of the planet.
The reason Venus is like hell seems to be what's called the greenhouse effect. The greenhouse effect can make an Earth-like world into a planetary inferno.
We talked to Anne Bruyan, wife of the late Carl Sagan, about Cosmos, possibly the greatest science documentary series ever made.
There are lots of examples of how people have been fascinated by astronomy on a popular level over the years. So you could see a game of astronomy Monopoly, or you could even see a telescope that somebody managed to build by themselves out of old bean tin cans, car parts and wire coat hangers.
And we visit the Science Museum to nose around their latest exhibit on the crossover between cosmology and culture. All that plus a rise in animal experiments in the UK, the discovery that humans glow in the dark, and a possible child for our favourite tortoise, Lonesome George. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome to the show, everyone, and welcome also back to an old friend, and old being the operative word, Ian Sample. Welcome back.
Good to be here.
What have you been doing? Writing a book?
Yeah, I've been getting cabin fever.
And it's making squirrel traps.
I've been hazing squirrels rather than trapping them.
Nell Bose is also here, by the way. Have you, Nell, you paid this man salary. Were you wondering what he was doing for the last 6 weeks? That's just a giggle. There's a line through your name on a piece of paper she's got there. Our guest this week is the writer and environmentalist Jonathan Porritt. He's the founder director of the sustainable development NGO Forum for the Future, and until this month served as the chair of the UK Sustainable Development Commission. That's the government's principal source of independent advice across the whole sustainable development agenda. His past positions have included being director of Friends of the Earth and a trustee of WWF. He came into the pod to give the government a scorecard on how they were doing tackling climate change. But he started by telling me how a better informed public was also crucial to giving politicians the mandate they needed to act decisively.
It's never been more important to emphasise science communications and the enormous value that this brings to society today. People are still unbelievably confused about some of these big issues, whether it's climate change or genetically modified food or nuclear power, whatever it might be. And the debate that we have must be founded on the best possible science, and we need scientists to be out there using their own judgment and their insights to help bring people to a greater sense of awareness.
Many people use the excuse that actually this is really complicated stuff, so something like a 2-degree sea rise or a 3-degree sea rise or that kind of thing is simpler to understand for people who aren't steeped in this information all the time. Would you agree with that? And if not, then what would you suggest is the better way of communicating that?
I think this is changing, to be fair. I'm just listening to young people in school today, both in primary and secondary school. They're coming out into their university or their jobs, whatever it is, infinitely better informed than today's adults are. They understand that this is happening. They are really cross, indeed angry about the fact that this is happening and that it seems as if no one's consulted them about all of this. So this is a generational thing. The truth is that today's politicians have little understanding of this still, scientifically. They feel ill-prepared, ill-equipped to comment on it knowledgeably in public. And for that reason, they're failing their electorate by not helping people to see that this is not just a sort of not terribly worrying thing that we can cope with and we'll all be a little bit browner.
What about the fact that there are other fish to fry for politicians at the moment around the world, economically speaking? That perhaps climate is something so long-term that it's not something that they're focused on now because otherwise our institutions will fall apart, banks fall apart, that kind of thing.
I've always argued that politicians have a dual responsibility. They have to do what they have to do to keep things ticking over today whilst preparing for a very different world in the future. And this is one of those classic instances. You can't say, oh, we'll do climate change once we've sorted out the global financial crisis. This is, again, just fantastically badly informed politics. The upside of this is that actually they can help sort out the global financial crisis by doing more about climate change, by making investments in green technologies and green infrastructure.
Well, let's move on to that, actually. I remember reading on your blog recently, there was a piece about renewables. Now, you were a bit confused about them by saying you weren't sure whether it was a good or a bad time for renewables. Can you articulate that a bit for us?
Well, it is confusing, and at least I'm one of those people who own up when I'm confused rather than just assume total confidence in everything I'm saying. It's a difficult time to read because there's a lot of resource coming into renewables now. 2008 saw the greatest ever level of investment in renewables of any preceding year, and the first year ever when investment in renewables exceeded investment in fossil fuels. So that's good. But on the other hand, we're hearing all sorts of stories about big investors pulling out of markets like the UK and other European countries. Flows of money across 2009 are likely to be much less than 2008 because of the credit crunch. Governments still aren't doing everything they ought to do at this time. So you've got a mixed picture, and the worst thing for investors is a mixed picture. Investors are looking for near regulatory certainty about this stuff. That's what helps them get behind the new investments.
The problem, of course, is that the big energy companies are pulling out of all their renewable projects. And is that a cause for worry, do you think? Or were they never going to be interested anyway?
I guess we've all gone along with the idea that the big fossil fuel companies could transmogrify themselves into integrated energy companies and that they'd get in their portfolio a mixture of fossil fuels.
Did you believe that?
Yeah, I did, actually. If I'm being fair, I did. Because I thought to myself, why just head off towards extinction? Why not do the obvious thing, which is to transition away from this profoundly unsustainable energy mix that we've got at the moment into one that actually would serve people's needs just as well and provide for a far better world for 9 billion people by 2050? And it just seemed to me that you would sometimes seek to override shareholder dominance in matters of this kind, but they fail to do that in reality.
So who is going to step into that breach in terms of renewables?
I'm very excited by the fact that capitalism has a wonderful history of writing off those corporate interests that can no longer provide society and shareholders with the value it needs. And I have little doubt that into this space will come literally thousands of new companies, startups to big propositions, which will fill this gap on both efficiency and renewables in a way that will create trillions of dollars for shareholders in the future.
Okay. You're going to step down from being the chair of the Sustainable Development Commission soon. And this was a very senior government advisory role. Since 2000, when you've had that role, are you more optimistic now than you were then about the government's attitude to tackling climate change?
I'm not any more optimistic than I was in 2000, but I'm certainly a lot wiser. I've seen how difficult it is for a government to get its head around this. I've seen how excessive enthusiasm for global rhetoric often detracts from what needs to be done on the ground in terms of nitty-gritty policy. We've been overwhelmed by all sorts of very big-picture global positions from both Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. We lead the world on climate rhetoric and indeed on target setting, but we're way down the league tables in terms of delivery, and particularly bad on both energy efficiency and renewables. So the rhetoric-delivery gap has become more and more painful to me as chair of the Sustainable Development Commission. And it's only really in the last 6 months that I've seen this government begin to realize its own failures in that area and start to address it. And that is now happening.
People blame politicians for not doing stuff quickly enough. But do you think actually the message is that it's actually up to members of the public to give them the mandate?
Yeah, this cuts both ways. Politicians will only take the kind of electoral risks they think are manageable and justifiable. They need to know that the general public is moving in that direction. But to be absolutely honest, all the opinion polls tell us that public opinion has been far more predisposed to radical measures in this area than politicians have argued. It's just a lack of leadership, a lack of recognition of the fact that people want a clear steer here and they want the legislative framework to be laid out very clearly.
Do you think Labour cares about climate change?
Labour cares about climate change, but it doesn't care about climate change enough to mainstream it into the rest of their politics. And in that regard, it's never quite got the traction either across Parliament or across government or across the country that it should have got.
One final thing. The Tories seem to be quite a bit more progressive on the climate front than Labour, which is surprising in some ways. If the Tories do get into government in the next year or so, would you be more optimistic about what they're going to do, their plans?
It's always easier for a party in opposition to sound as if they're going to sort out the world. And I'm pleased to say that I think the Conservative Party have done a lot of work on this. They've been doing their homework. Their low carbon economy strategy, for instance, is as good as anything that has come out of this government. And I've said that to government ministers without any hesitation. Whether they'll stick to it, make it the priority that needs to be, drive it with the vigour that politicians will have to drive this agenda, that's another issue, and I'm sort of quite relieved that I won't be there to worry about it on the SDC.
Environmentalist Jonathan Porritt there. He may have stepped down from government service, but you can still find his thoughts on his blog, which is regularly updated at jonathanporritt.com. Now it's time for the stories that matter this week. Here's the News Jam.
News Jam.
The number of experiments in the UK involving animals leapt by 14% last year to 3.7 million. The figures were met with dismay by animal rights campaigners, but Science Minister Lord Drayson said Britain has a good reputation for regulating animal research, which he said is critical for developing new medicines and improving our understanding of disease.
The European Space Agency has opened its first research centre in the UK. The new facility at Harwell Science Park in Oxfordshire will focus on climate change and robotic space exploration, and will develop procedures to ensure missions to other planets do not contaminate them with chemicals and microbes from Earth.
Researchers in Japan have shown that humans glow in the dark, albeit at an intensity 1,000 times weaker than the human eye can detect. The scientists used ultra-sensitive cameras to image volunteers' bodies and found that the light was emitted most strongly by the cheeks, forehead, neck, and fluctuated over a 24-hour cycle.
And finally, Lonesome George, the last surviving giant tortoise from Pinter Island in the Galapagos, and renowned for being the rarest creature in the world, may be about to become a dad at over 90 years of age. One of his two female companions has laid 5 eggs, but conservationists will have to wait until November before they know for sure whether they can expect the patter of tiny giant tortoise feet.
Nell, Ian, thanks both for those. Ian, let's go into that animal story. The number of experiments on animals has risen 14%. As you said in the story, there's 3.7 million procedures last year. What's driven that rise?
It's mostly, as ever, a big rise in mice. And much of that is creating breeding mice with single gene defects. So you can knock a gene out in a mouse, breed those, and you can study exactly what that one particular gene does in development, in all kinds of things. And a lot of these mice are actually exported. I mean, not all of them stay in the country. I mean, we have in the Sanger Centre up in Cambridge, one of the sort of, you know, prime facilities in the country for producing these mice. So yeah, a lot of them go elsewhere. Also zebrafish have been on the rise. So again, you know, these sort of, you know, short-lived, very fast sort of breeding fish that you can do a lot of studies with. We've seen a rise in the use of old world monkeys. New world monkeys have actually gone down more than 50%. There's been a 30-odd% rise in old world monkeys, and that's because they are closer to us physiologically, immunologically, and so on. And one reason for that is that, not the sole reason, but one reason for that is Northwick Park, which is a hospital in North London where a clinical trial in 2006 went disastrously wrong, essentially, where the drug that was given, which was a type of monoclonal antibody, induced an enormous immune reaction in the patients, and 6 of them were nearly killed, actually, by that. Now a lot of these companies have to do very rigorous non-human primate studies with those drugs before they can get them into human trials, but also a lot of pharmaceutical companies are now focusing on those kinds of compounds. These are the cutting-edge drugs. You know, small molecules, they call them in the industry. These are the new drugs, which are very precision drugs and are, you know, hopefully the future of curing diseases.
Let's move on to space now. There's a new facility opened up in Harwell near Oxfordshire to do the sort of earth monitoring and a few of these other sort of robotic sort of type things. We had, obviously, in the last few months, our first astronaut from Britain, Major Tim Peake. And there were some reports and papers last weekend about the UK reversing its policy on a sort of tacit ban of human spaceflight, which turned out to be a bit flaky in the end. Where does this Harwell facility fit into all of that?
Well, the Hubble facility is it's a disused building at the moment. It's a former computing lab that was built in the 60s that ESA is going to occupy. It's mostly going to be offices, essentially. It's going to have a fairly small core staff, and then people will come to work there to do certain projects. But it's got a pretty broad remit. I mean, the money has been earmarked but not approved yet by the member states, and the money will have to come out of existing ESA projects. So there's no new money for this. But what it does do is it gives Britain its first ESA facility. We're the only member state within ESA that doesn't have its own ESA facility. And it's going to focus on things like using data from satellites to tweak climate change models and improve those. It's going to look at robotics for rover missions and things like that.
But does it bring us any closer to official British astronauts, any of that stuff, which we know that Paul Drayson, the science minister, is kind of a fan of, but you know that you have to... He's not made any overt indications that Britons will be going into space beyond Tim Peake, of course.
At the sort of opening ceremony for this facility in London last week, Lord Drayson confirmed that the policy ban on human spaceflight in Britain has been lifted. The strange thing is ESA, European Space Agency, has selected a Brit to be an astronaut, an official astronaut. So we have an official astronaut, and that was done by sorts of good work, I think, a good strategy on Lord Drayson's behalf. To say we now no longer oppose it as policy is different to saying we fund it. We're not going to put any money into it still. And saying the ban is lifted might be as easy as saying the ban is lifted. I don't think this has had to go through some sort of legislative nightmarish process to do it.
Well, I was interested in the bit of it that's devoted to contamination of other worlds. And how is that an issue that's kind of becoming more important?
Well, what's they call this planetary protection, and it's
which is the most hubristic title I've ever heard.
But I love it that one of these like an old 1960s block in South Oxfordshire is going to become Britain's centre of protecting planets elsewhere and also Earth. I mean, you know, we're not excluded from this. What it amounts to in the large part is whenever you send a probe to another planet, you have to make sure it doesn't take any rubbish from Earth with it, like bugs and chemicals.
So you don't discover life on another planet, which actually has come with you from Earth.
Exactly, basically. Yeah. But also so that
wipe it out.
Yeah. And you know all the chemicals and so on that are on board on that probe. So when you land and you find something, you can't say, oh, I found organics. There must be life on this planet. It's like, well, you found a bit of the fuel that got you there. And so, you know, there's a sort of... A necessary auditing
There's
process,
sort of
but you are
scientific rigor there. But is there a sort of wider?
Well, there is at the more sort of exotic level of interpretation. This idea that you don't want to take bugs to another planet because there's sort of an ideological issue against it. What if they take hold? I mean, so we are getting quite sort of speculative. But there is an element of this also where Harwell will produce research which looks at how we should quarantine material brought back from planets where we're not sure if there's life or not. Everything at the moment we know is dead. You've got, you know, bits of meteorite and bits of moon rock, and they're dead as anything, and you can keep them in your sort of, you know, in your fridge if you like. They'll have a containment facility for those things, but it'll just be a clean room to protect them rather than us. When it comes around to getting sort of Mars material, maybe they'll be a bit more cautious. It may be that you just have to put things in quarantine until you're sure.
Now, I was going to try and move on to some feedback, but Nell, you made some noises about... You had one last question. What was it?
I just wanted to ask Ian.
Ian's the man to answer this.
Well, I gather he is. Why do we care about Lonesome George? I mean, really?
This woman has no heart left.
Let him die.
I think your question is the most just heartless, depressing... inhumane thing I've heard in so long. This is a species well publicized to be on the brink of extinction, i.e. he's the last one. I agree with you, maybe we shouldn't care what one tortoise gets up to, and you know, we don't think about it every day. But when he does, when the females he's enclosed with do start popping out eggs, and you've got to bear in mind that tortoises are a bit like chickens, that they can pop out eggs without being fertilized. Yeah. And when they do pop out eggs, you might as well think maybe he's gone and done it. There is
no
something.
No one's seen him do anything, by the way.
No one's ever seen him actually in the act. So it's all There's something.
I think we're going to carry on covering this. We're going to keep. Well, he's got another 100 years or so before he does die.
But
so
he's kind of like the Bruce Forsyth of the animal world, and I think there's something fairly gruesome about.
No, you're thinking
about,
John Humphreys, isn't it? John Humphreys had a baby when he was 60.
Something gruesome about our interest in that. There's people like the fact that it's an old bloke.
Let's move on to some of feedback now. This is some feedback on last week's podcast, Rise of the Biological Machines, when we had Paul Fremont, the synthetic biologist from Imperial College. And so Entropy Man said,
I was disappointed that your panel did not ask Paul Fremont to discuss more seriously the difference between a nanobot, a nano-engineered item, and a biologic. The panel let Prof. Fremont idly dismiss any concerns about such biologics with a comment that he hoped it would not develop into another GM issue. The point is that biological engineering promises much, but, unlike inorganic materials, these organic materials are subject to evolution. It's hard to predict how they might end up if they develop an ability to replicate.
On the blog, Harmony Future posted,
thanks to the gravity well of Jupiter, much of the detritus that would otherwise find its way into the inner solar system is captured by this gas giant. Thanks, Jupiter.
There's some. Don't look around you sort of things there. Thanks, ants. Thanks.
thanks, like, Jupiter.
Like the 80s wrote, I was 8 when I watched you walk on the moon. This is to Buzz Aldrin, by the way, not to anyone on this pod. I was 8 when I watched you walk on the moon on a tiny black and white telly. It was the most inspiring thing I ever saw and still is. Harry Mott posted,
love your work, Buzz, particularly Toy Story. That film is a classic.
Now, not only can you leave your thoughts and comments about this week's show on our site, but there's also more on all the stories from the News Jam there too. And you can keep up to date with everything through our Twitter feeds. The links you need are guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. The astronomer Carl Sagan is known for many things. He was a prolific scientist, pioneering the study of exobiology and astrochemistry, and promoting the search for extraterrestrial life. He also wrote scores of books, including several novels, where he demonstrated his skill for taking the most complex ideas and turning them into captivating stories. One of his biggest achievements was Cosmos, a 13-part science documentary series first aired in the United States in 1980. In it, he took viewers on a journey around the universe, describing everything from atoms to galaxies, and set the gold standard for science on television.
Matter is much older than life. Billions of years before the Sun and Earth even formed, atoms were being synthesized in the insides of hot stars, and then returned to space when the stars blew themselves up. Newly formed planets were made of this stellar debris. The Earth and every living thing are made of star stuff.
The late, great Carl Sagan there in Cosmos. Last week I spoke to Anne Bruyan, who was married to Carl Sagan until his death in 1996, and was also one of the writers on Cosmos. I started by asking her where the idea for the documentary series came from.
In the brain and soul of Carl Sagan, it was, in some sense, although not completely, a compendium of the best stories and ideas that Carl had gathered over the course of his years of teaching. We wanted to tell the broader story of how we as a species set about over the course of generations beginning to understand our coordinates in space and time.
What's one of your favorite episodes? There's 13 in total, and as you say, it goes from everything from the whole universe down to the smallest atoms and so on. What was one of the things that really stood out for you?
The one that I find most inspiring and uplifting is episode 2, which is about the origin of life, the evolution of life on this planet, and the possibility of life elsewhere.
There were many kinds of molecules in the primordial soup. Some were attracted to water on one side and repelled by it on the other. This drove them together into a tiny enclosed spherical shell, like a soap bubble, which protected the interior. Within the bubble, the ancestors of DNA found a home, and the first cell arose.
By the end of it, you feel a kind of personal responsibility to preserve and to protect that ancient continuity, that you are a link in a chain.
A lot of scientists sort of look down on the kinds of things Carl did in terms of public engagement with science. And nowadays, everyone does it. Did that affect the way he made the program?
No, because he was fearless. And he had a conviction that science is not only a birthright that belongs to absolutely everyone, especially because you know, virtually all science is funded publicly. But a society that is based on science and high technology, in which only an elite few understand its workings, its methods, its values, its language, means that our hopes of ever developing a democratic society are imperiled. And, you know, that's why we tell the story of Alexandria.
Of that legendary library, all that survives is this dank and forgotten cellar. But this place was once the brain and glory of the greatest city on the planet Earth.
Ancient Alexandria was the greatest collection of the world's knowledge up to its time, but it was only the preserve of a tiny priesthood. It wasn't used to, in any way, improve the lives of the people of Alexandria, but it was a kind of luxury item. And when the early Christians came to tear down that library, there was no one to stand up and prevent them, because science belonged to so few.
It's amazing how the whole series touches on even very contemporary issues. And what would someone watching this series now, what would they get from it?
The fact is, the science is rigorous, and Carl was prophetic. He was the first person to actually know the correct temperature of the planet Venus, and because of his ethos, he immediately began wondering what he could learn about the atmosphere of the Earth and potential inadvertent climate change through our technological civilization.
The reason Venus is like hell seems to be what's called the greenhouse effect. The greenhouse effect can make an Earth-like world into a planetary inferno.
Carl was constantly accused of being highly speculative as a scientist. And yet, I think you'll agree that to see cosmos now, 30 years later, is to see someone who is actively, you know, and effectively foretelling much of the issues that we are grappling with right at this moment.
The hell of Venus is in stark contrast with the comparative heaven of its neighboring world, our little planetary home, the Earth. Here, the atmosphere is 90 times thinner. Here, the carbon dioxide and water vapor make a modest greenhouse effect, which heats the ground above the freezing point of water. Without it, our oceans would be frozen solid. A little greenhouse effect is a good thing. But Venus is an ominous reminder that on a world rather like the Earth, things can go wrong. There is no guarantee that our planet will always be so hospitable. To maintain this clement world, we must understand it and appreciate it.
In the decades since Cosmos was produced, entirely new subjects have come along, entirely new challenges have come along. If Carl was alive today and making the 14th episode, what would you think he would put in it?
I think he'd be interested in the mysteries of dark matter, in the discoveries made recently about Titan and Mars, and I'm sure that he would be cheering on NASA and the other space agencies of the world in their ongoing programs of exploration.
That was Anne Brianne, one of the writers on Cosmos and the late Carl Sagan's wife. The music you heard at the start, by the way, was composed by Vangelis, part of a suite written specifically for the program. Listen, Podders, did you ever watch Cosmos or have anything to do with the works of Carl Sagan?
It's one of those kind of glaring holes in my DVD collection. I mean, now it's around, I'd love to watch it. I mean, I've been sad enough to be watching like Feynman lectures online and all sorts of things. And
great. They're great, though.
Yeah, Feynman, they are. I mean, he's, you know, it gets a bit extravagant, the kind of fuss about Feynman, but he is an amazing lecturer, and I think ditto with Carl Sagan. I mean, he enthuses you so much. I think it's a rare thing, and I'd love to watch it.
I sort of wish you could kind of get away from the repetition that you get in the current scientific documentaries of that sort of part format that keeps repeating and never seems to get anywhere, and go back to the kind of
This is this is
the originals.
A 13-hour film about the universe, essentially, sliced into one-hour episodes. And they used special effects for the first time in science documentaries. They had music, obviously, Vangelis and others. And it was just, it was a very beautifully written, almost filmic thing, which is very useful because now it's back on DVD. So now it's competition time. Science competition. All 13 episodes of Cosmos are now available in a glorious box set, and three lucky Science Weekly listeners can win themselves a copy. All you need to do is answer this fiendishly difficult question. What was the name of Carl Sagan's novel, which was made into a film starring Jodie Foster? Go to our blog for the link to the competition and details on how to enter. That's at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. There you'll find a repeat of that question and also full terms and conditions.
Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jar.
Last week, the Science Museum took the wraps off a new exhibition looking at the way astronomy has influenced culture and how it's changed our behaviour. Among the exhibits are Thomas Harriot's early moon map, William Herschel's telescope, which he used to discover Uranus, and even a commemorative tea towel celebrating the 1999 solar eclipse over Cornwall. We sent Science Weekly intern Jacob Aaron down to the museum for the afternoon, where he spoke with two of the curators of the exhibit.
My name's Alison Boyle. I'm the curator of the Cosmos and Culture exhibition, which has just opened at the Science Museum. We've spent the last year or so getting out there preparing an exhibition about the history of astronomy and how astronomy has influenced the way we see ourselves as well as the way we see the universe. So we've assembled a huge range of things for people to see. There's a huge range of different types of objects in the exhibition. Obviously, it's an astronomy exhibition, so you would expect to see a telescope. What you might not expect to see is the different kind of sizes and shapes the telescopes come in. You can see a replica of Galileo's telescope and the kind of simple wooden tube that he would have used to make some of his earliest observations of the sun and moon. But you can also see examples of a radio telescope, of a gamma ray telescope, which looks at very high energy parts of the universe, of telescopes that are used in space, but also even detectors that are used underground. There's a detector that's been used in a mine in Yorkshire for the last few years attempting to detect the dark matter that astronomers think makes up most of the universe.
Yeah, so that big detector caught my eye. It looks like sort of a giant oven. How exactly is that used?
The detector is called DRIFT, and it's looking for particles. We can only see 4% of the stuff in the universe, and astronomers believe that some of the rest of the stuff that we can't see is made of something called dark matter. We know it's there because of its gravitational effects, because it's the motion of galaxies means that there must be more mass in the universe that we can see. And one theory for what might make up this dark matter is something called weakly interacting massive particles. So this detector was in a mine, in a shielded environment, trying to detect these particles. It ran for several years. It didn't manage to detect any particles, but that doesn't mean they're not there. There are now more powerful experiments happening in that same mine, which may manage to detect signs of dark matter.
My name is Rim Turkmani. I'm an astronomer from the Imperial College and I'm a research fellow of the Royal Society. I got involved in helping to describe and introduce astronomical objects that were used by the Arabs during the Middle Ages. These objects, especially the Ori quadrant, are a great example of how important it was to determine your position and your time during that period. Because not only in Islam, but many other religions which were present in the Middle East around that time, the religious rituals were often depending on the movement of the objects in the sky. When does the sun rise? When does it set? When is the Passover, for example? You know, when is Ramadan for the Muslims? Even the Islamic calendar, it was a lunar calendar, so it depends on the observation of the moon. In Islam also, you have to determine the direction of Mecca, so you need to be able to do that wherever you are in the globe. So the Ori quadrant, for example, is a very simple but very clever tool which can be used to measure the altitude of any object in the sky. And if you do it with the sun, then you can actually tell exactly what time it is. The concept behind it is very simple. The quadrant looks like a quarter of a circle. It measures the angle of altitude of the sun to determine the time, and that's, you know, very easy. For example, if the sun is just rising or just setting, the angle of altitude should be zero.
These are quite sophisticated devices. Were they improved upon as time went by, or are these devices still used now?
They were improved upon. I mean, they were passed to Europe and they remained very popular in Europe. Of course, by the invention of the clocks, we stopped using these devices. But for many astronomers, they remained a very easy way of instantly telling the time.
So these Islamic devices had a significant effect on the development of astronomy in the West then?
Oh, indeed, yes. The theory of the astronomy, which was developed by the Arabs, of course, it was inherited by the Greeks and other sources, so there's some diverse sources, and they made some corrections, they built on it, they developed it immensely, and they tried to compare the theory to the observations, and where they see a mismatch, they would just pause and say, well, wait a minute, this doesn't work.
There's lots of items in the exhibition that are the kind of things that ordinary people would have used to either do astronomy or to engage with astronomy. There are lots of examples of how people have been fascinated by astronomy on a popular level over the years. So you could see a fan inspired by the comet of 1811, which caused much public excitement. Or you could see a game of astronomy Monopoly, or you could even see a telescope that somebody managed to build by themselves out of old bean tin cans, car parts and wire coat hangers.
So that's one way to get involved in astronomy, by building your own telescope. And it seems it's been a very exciting week for astronomy. We've had the anniversary of the moon landing, the eclipse, and also the surprise collision with Jupiter. How else can people get involved in astronomy?
There are lots of astronomy societies around the country, and if you look on the web, you can normally find people near you if you want to actually get out and see some astronomy for yourself. If you can't actually get outside to get access to astronomy, you can actually do quite a lot of astronomy on the web. There are projects like Galaxy Zoo, where you can actually interact and help astronomers classify galaxies yourself. Or you can get involved in the hunt for signals from extraterrestrial intelligence. So without actually even leaving your house, if you have access to a computer, you can get involved in actual astronomical research too.
That was Alison Boyle and also Rim Turkmani. The exhibition Cosmos and Culture is on now at the Science Museum in London. That's it for this week's show. Thanks to Ian Sample and Nell Bowes for wise words, and also to Jonathan Porritt. Many grateful thanks also to James Kingland and our ill but still functioning intern, Jacob Aaron. I'm Alok Jha, and the programme is produced by Scott Corley. Thanks for listening.